This edition of the Packet Pushers podcast is brought to you by Infinetta Systems, a leading innovator and provider of hyperscale WAN optimization solutions. Infinetta's WAN optimization product, the Data Mobility Switch, allows enterprises to expand and fill large WAN links. Companies benefit from increased WAN utilization, improved application performance, and cost savings from fewer bandwidth upgrades. Infinetta helps you move more data more quickly using less bandwidth. Get more information at www.infinetta.com.
Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real engineers get together to talk, dissect, and review work life in the networking industry. This week, in the start of the new year, that is 2012, Ethan and I thought we'd just get together and go mano-mano, one-on-one, and talk tech about whatever it is that's taken our fancy for this week. How are you today, Mr. Banks?
Doing good. I'm ready for the holidays to be over. And in fact, they just about are. This is the day after New Year's, and I've got a holiday today. And then tomorrow, I'll be back at it at work, thinking about how to spend my company's money on the budget items that they've approved for 2012 and going at it full speed ahead and looking forward to it.
Spend early, spend fast is my advice.
In case they take it away, you don't want to change your mind.
That's right. Purchase orders by the middle of January, I suggest. So I thought the first thing that we would do, since it's just the two of us on the show, talk a little bit about what the plans are for Packet Pushers for 2012. We've got various ideas about what we should do to get the show going in different directions. But as you know, we've taken on sponsorship last year. We probably had a few too many sponsored shows in the last quarter, didn't we, I think?
A bit. What seemed to happen, and vendors, perk up your ears a second, because we know a lot of you folks listen to the podcast. We just had a lot of folks come at us at once that wanted to sponsor a show to get their message out, to talk with us about their product. And we did have a lot of great shows and some interesting content that came up, but it did get to be a little overwhelming. So, you know, at this point, I think we already have quarter one of 2012 filled up with the slots that we're going to allow for sponsored shows.
Yeah, we are limiting the number of sponsored shows as well. So we aren't just going to willy-nilly fill up do everything as a sponsored slot. We want to have both sponsored content, which gives us some money and some motivation to keep things going, and also to have the good stuff, you know, the conversations that interest us that aren't necessarily, which are orthogonal, aren't always aligned to what the vendors want to hear or what they want to say, but things that we think are relevant about the industry.
Well, the things that keep, the way we got started was, of course, being an independent show, and we definitely have to keep that vibe going on. That's what makes the show as listenable as it is, because we have the opportunity to share an independent opinion as opposed to something that's a paid marketing message, if you will.
Yes, and that's important to us, that independence. So that's why we clearly mark the shows as sponsored, both in the blog and in the title, and we introduce them as sponsored shows and so forth and so on. And, you know, in a real sense, the vendors are coming into our house. They're actually joining us as guests, you know, and that's how we sort of think about it. So you wouldn't be rude to your guests when they come to your house, and that's kind of the vision that we have for those sorts of shows.
Mm. Yeah. And we've had good success with that. Yeah. We still try to ask a few tough questions, but we're very nice about it.
That's true. But we're also asking the vendors to come with nerd stuff. So keep it technical. You know, we don't want to have a, you know, ShamWow type of, you know, look, it cleans, it wipes.
We've avoided that successfully, I think. Honestly, we've gotten good feedback on the vendor-sponsored shows. But
yes, I think so. I'd like to think so, at least anyway, that we're trying to find a balance. But if anybody wants to sort of give us any feedback on that, then please write to us at packetpushers@gmail.com. We really value feedback from people. We are continuing to aim at about one show a week. It's difficult to record more than one because the shows do require a fair bit of preparation, and they also require a lot of administration in terms of editing and writing that goes with them and putting them out there. So it's hard to do more than that. And I think some people are struggling to listen to more than one a week as well.
Yeah, including me. Yeah. I mean, some more things that we wanted to do this year. We definitely want to get more folks on the show that have never been on before. I put out a thread on the LinkedIn group and asked, who would you like to hear that you have never heard on the podcast before? And we got a lot of interesting suggestions that came in through that. And so we've been in contact with some of those folks, and a few folks as a result of that thread were on a pretty recent show. We had Scott Morris on, for example. He was able to show up, and Chris Marget, his fragmentationneeded.net blog is pretty popular as folks have found it, and we were able to have him on the show, and we're going to keep looking for more people that are there. And of course, we'll bring back the regular folks that have come on a lot and contributed and spent time with us to add their viewpoints to the podcast, like Ivan Pepelniak and Mrs. Y and Tom Hollingsworth and other folks like that. And then I'll put in a plug here for the blogging that's been happening on packetpushers.net, where we've brought in a lot of folks who are out there on Twitter and participate with Packet Pushers and listen to the show and wanted to blog with us. I've set up a lot of folks with a lot of accounts, and we've gotten some really great content that's out there. We're going to add more bloggers. If you're interested in blogging, just send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com. Let us know, hey, I'd like to blog too. Tell us a little bit about yourself so we know who you are and what your background is. And I tend to deal with most of the blogging and the bloggers and the editing of that content and so on, and I'll get you set up.
That's true, and Packet Pushers is getting stronger. It's now getting something like 2,000 page views a day. That means that if you've got just one blog post in you, maybe it's time to have a look at how to do that. We'd be more than pleased to sign you up so that you get a voice. It's a good platform. And if you do have your own blog, you are welcome to, you know, submit an article to Packet Pushers, and we'll happily link back to your blog as well. Everybody's welcome. It's all a community thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't take copyright or ownership. It's all about sharing and talking about what happens in our industry and participating. We will continue our relationship with Tech Field Day this year. We look forward to planning and assisting with the Network Field Day. We've got two Network Field Days planned for this year, where we will be meeting with vendors and talking with vendors. So if the vendors are still listening, if you'd like to get involved and to meet the Packet Pushers and to meet with a lot of other bloggers, get in touch with us and let's talk about how we can get your company to come along. I will continue to blog at Ethereal Mind for the coming year, I think. I'm enjoying having my own space. Sometimes I think I should blog at Packet Pushers, you know, Ethan. I wonder if I should start putting a few posts over there.
Couldn't hurt. I mean, we've had some of the more luminous beings out there in the blogosphere have come over and contributed content. It's been pretty great. Derek Winkworth, for example, blogged a post the other day that was career oriented, how to be good at IT stuff, and that got picked up on Reddit and just, you know, went through the roof as far as hit counts. It was did really, really well. And yeah, when folks that are popular contribute to packetpushers.net, it really just extends that feeling of community that's out there. It's a good thing.
And lots of comments, too. We'd like to do more with the comments.
So another thought that we've had for 2012 would be to start a Packet Pushers forum site, which is, you know, the idea there would be to give people who don't necessarily want to blog but maybe have questions or want to interact, kind of like the LinkedIn group a little bit, but really that more of a moderated forum style of a site where you come in, you can ask questions. Maybe it's a technical problem. I am trying to redistribute OSPF into BGP, and I'm having this particular technical challenge. Any of you guys out there, help me. And then you could have a dialogue back and forth to resolve those sorts of problems. Or I'm considering a blue coat proxy and I don't know enough about it and it seems kind of expensive for my application. Do I really want to go down this avenue or not? What do you think? You get a forum out there that allows for more back and forth dialogue and probably have an email option, because some people don't like to go up and read the forum, but they wouldn't mind getting the forum pumped into their mailbox that they can read and respond that way. So for Greg and I, that's an idea right now. We haven't really had the time to dig into exactly how to do that. I've had some contact with a few of you that listen to the show regularly offline and know that you're interested in maybe helping moderate or getting it set up. And if there's others of you that are interested in that, maybe acting as a moderator or helping to get the site built, you have a platform that you know works well, is reasonably secure, we would be interested in talking with you. So again, shoot an email to packetpushers@gmail.com if you have some interest in working with us on a moderated forum site, and let us know. We want to chat about that.
Some of the challenges there are significant. Running a forum is a complex and resource-intensive thing to do. And although we could do something like this on LinkedIn where people could ask questions and foster a group, I'm personally very concerned about the level of tracking that goes on those sites. So LinkedIn makes money from watching what you talk about, and Facebook, you know, makes money from selling your information to other companies. There's just so much of that going on that it actually chases us away. And especially if you want to talk about security stuff, there are very serious concerns that you might be leaking corporate information if you put them on some of those public sites. So I would think we would rather do something that's our own rather than to use somebody else's, because we don't want to be limited by somebody else's platform that doesn't necessarily do what we want. And also because you should own the content. It shouldn't be stolen from you and then sold to make money. Hopefully we can find something that, you know, we can support with a small amount of advertising revenue. And not, we're not planning to make a $1 billion Facebook empire, multi-billion-dollar Facebook empire out of your personal information, is sort of a thing. It's a hard one. We don't want to take on more work than we've already got, but we would also like to see the community extended and give people more participation, because I think the blog has shown that there are people who've got great things to share with people and a lot more details. So I think we probably should stop talking about ourselves and move on to talking about some tech stuff. You and I were having a conversation earlier this week about fiber optic cabling, and I can't remember how it came up.
Well, it came up like this. My whining a bit in one of my blog posts about things that would be things that would be nice to have if the world was a perfect place, and I've always been a little disheartened at the difficulty it is to make your own fiber optic cable. It's gotten better. Back in the days, I remember hiring a contractor to come in and do some fiber optic runs for us, where, you know, he had this very special kit and had to polish the ends of the fiber, and he had to look through a scope to make sure the ends of the fiber were quite clean and all that. And we've gotten beyond that, where the tools are certainly easier to use, but it was still... you can't go to Best Buy and buy an inexpensive fiber optic termination kit, because making a fiber cable, there's still more technical wherewithal required to make that work. It's not like a copper cable. You trim the ends, get your colors in order, stuff it into an RJ45, crimp it, test it, done. It's not that easy. And but Greg's had some background in this.
The flip side of that is, of course, that now that we're using for 10 gig E, the Cat 6 cable, you can't make that yourself. It's physically impossible for a person to just hand make that with a pair of pliers and an RJ45 crimp connector, because you would unwind too much, or you wouldn't get a solid enough connection, and you would actually have poor quality fiber optic cables. One of the things to remember is that Cat 6E cable is required for 10 gigabase T, and you can't make those cables yourself. You need to be done in a factory.
For sure, for the 10 gig stuff, but there's not too many people that are doing that. There's very little that's out there that's able to be done. But if you look back historically, you could work right with up to Cat 6 and make a certifiable cable, yourself. And you would have to be careful not to unwind too much and so on. As you say, you want to lose those twists, because then you possibly introduce a bit of vulnerability into the cable.
Yes. difficult.
With the 10 gig stuff, we're not there anymore. But I'd be curious to see actually how many 10 gig certified copper cabling plants we're actually going to see that are going to run on Cat 6A. It seems unlikely to me that we'll see a big deployment of that. It's going to be, I think we're going to see a lot more fiber deployed out there in the data center.
The trick with Cat 6 is that in years gone by, fiber optic cable, you couldn't bend it more than this much, or the fiber core would snap. Right. Remember back then, then we got over that because the glass fiber that's in the middle of the fiber optic got more and more elastic, and you could bend it more. But fiber optic cables are still susceptible to actually snapping. Now the same thing applies in Cat 6. If you bend it in half and actually crimp it at the end, you actually change the electrical characteristics of the copper. The copper there actually gets work hardened, and reflections come off that. And it's my understanding at this point in time that a simple crimp in the cable will actually lose its Cat 6-ness. Because you're actually the signal won't propagate forward, and there'll also be reflections back, which will be interpreted as near in crosstalk back at the transmit side. On the receiving side, and that causes all sorts of problems. And I think there's a lot of these issues that haven't been realized by people, but a recent article which claims that 10 gigabase T will be the way of the future, because it'll come as a LOM, an LOM, which is a LAN on motherboard, and chips will Intel will ship a chip that will provide all of the networking functionality on the motherboard, and that's when 10 gigabit will finally arrive in the data center. You'll buy your Dell or HP server, and it'll have a 10 gigabit chip on the motherboard, and away you'll go. But there are several concerns around mechanical properties of those connectors and the cabling. The actual, if you read the IEEE specs, I've been through some of it, the actual performance of the Cat 6 is right up on the theoretical maximum 750 megahertz band. It's right there. Mm. And any degradation, any second, you know, any non-SAC Cat 6 RJ45 connectors, any non-Cat 6 patch panels can cause degradation. So if you have a Cat 6 cable and you run into a Cat 5 patch panel into a Cat 6 cable in the backbone, you've broken it. There's a lot of things going on here that in Cat 5, the actual signal spectrum of the available bandwidth was only running at, I think it was 60% or 70% of the overall spectral capacity. So there was a fair bit of degradation that could occur. So if you had some dodgy connectors or didn't do very good terminations, there was enough overhead. But at 10 gig, because the line rate is clocking, so 10 gigabit T is clocking so fast that there's not a lot of spectrum left and it has to be bang on the money. It's like at 85% of the spectral capacity. It can't degrade in any way before it really starts to fall apart. And I think we're going to see a lot of problems around that. That's why, now I may be proven wrong. We may see perfectly fine. But if you are going to use 10 gigabase T, don't use structured cabling is my advice. Just use patch leads. And if that means buying a 50-meter patch lead, then that's what you buy. I'd be reluctant, at least in the early days, until we get on top of the problems. But to come back to your fiber optic problem, in the early days of fiber optic cabling, companies used to talk about a thing called a mechanical splice. Did you see any? You ever seen those?
I have seen some of those, yeah. Now, I haven't used any of them myself, but that link that you showed me, which we'll put up in the show notes, showed several different styles of these splices where you can take two ends of a fiber optic cable and put them together in a way that minimizes loss.
Yeah, so you have a thing called a cleaver, which strips off the sheathing and exposes the fiber in the core of the cable. And then you push those two fibers down a tube. It's effectively like a little tube. And then in the middle of the tube, where you push the fibers in two ends of the cylindrical tube thing, there's this gel, which is light neutral. And so you sort of push the fibers in until they're as close together as you can, and then there's this gel between the two ends, and then you strap the cables down, and you've effectively got a light channel directly from one side to the other side that's perfectly workable. And these are very, very cheap to use. Like we're talking like $100 for an 8-port splice. And the way that you use them is this can actually is what they used to fix, or we used to use in the early days before fusion splicing came along. So what happened was in the early days of fiber optic cabling, there was a push by cabling companies to make a big deal out of their fusion splices. So a normal fusion splicing company uses a thing which is a very special machine, and they actually cut the cable, put it under a microscope, and see if the cleave is perfectly 90 degrees, right?
Mm-hmm, right?
And then they polish the end of it to make sure there's no residuals. So this is all, you know, 9 microns, so it's pretty specialist. And then they push the two fibers that you want to join together into a specialist thing, and then they flash a heating laser onto it, and that actually fuses the two glass cores back together again. Then they wrap a sheath back around it, and then they put that back into the thing. Now, the advantage of a fusion splice is that you're getting less than 0.1 dB of signal loss across that connection, whereas a mechanical splice gets about 0.3 dB of loss through a mechanical splice across that connector. Is that a problem? The answer is no, because in most data centers, you've got about 7.5 for multimode, and it's about 9.5 dB of signal overhead.
You've got so much signal strength there that the transceivers tend to be putting out that over the short distance that you're typically going to see in a data center, a small loss like that for a mechanical splice is negligible, really.
Yeah. You could put 5 mechanical splices in your fiber optic backbone to lose 1.5 dB. Your patch panel is going to take 0.1 dB because it actually matches the, you know, when the patch panel goes in, the fiber cores are very strongly aligned together. So there is an air gap, but they're very tight because of the lining. They're so tightly aligned. There's not a lot of loss between those two cores, and where the cable goes into the NIC is another point of loss. Patch panels where the two cables line up. Then you go through a few splices in your backbone, perhaps, and then you go through patch cables at the other end. And so each of those, so even if you had five mechanical splices for 1.5 dBs, and then you lose a couple of 0.1s or 0.2 dBs for patch panels at either end, you're never going to get more than 3 dBs of loss out of 7.5 dB of potential loss. So mechanical splice is a very fine way. So the way, how would you use a mechanical splice? You would go and buy a patch lead, a factory-made patch lead, so that the ends, so the actual connectors on each end, cut it in the middle, and then use those two ends. And that's called pigtails. Or you can actually buy pigtails from the factory. So when your fiber optic guy goes along, he actually comes in with a box of pigtails, which is the connectors and the fiber optic, which is the really hard part, is putting the, you know, the LC connector or the LX connectors into the, and the fiber optic into that. That's the hard part. Joining the fibers together is actually the easy part. So you go down the shop, you know, your local cabling company, you buy a box of pigtails, and they're about $100 each or less, $75 each for each one that you want. You screw them into the patch panel, and then at the get a box and put your mechanical splice in there and just splice all the fibers together, and you're done. That's how you do patch leads.
So then the question is, what does that cost compared to, I mean, when you go to do unshielded twisted pair for up to Cat 6, it's essentially a negligible cost. The cost of ends and the cost of the tools to put all this together is almost nothing. So if you want to buy yourself a box of cables, you can make your own custom patch cables. Go ahead. Buy whatever you need.
Well, you're not going to make a patch cable out of it, right? Because a patch cable is a different type of fiber. It's very elastic. It can bend and flex, and they're not the best thing to be mechanical splicing with, but, and this is somewhat of a specialist art form, because once you put the splice in, you need to test and validate that it's a good match. And but you should have, if you're running a data center today, you should have fiber optic testers for your cables, really, so that you can verify that they're working if something goes wrong, right?
Oh, absolutely. You should have some kind of a light meter that can inject light of different wavelengths down a particular piece of fiber and verify that your signal loss is within specs. You got to have that.
You got to have that. And every data center should have one in a cupboard somewhere. And so there's that. You can't use a mechanical splice with patch leads because it's mechanical, right? Because once you put the fibers in, you've got to screw them down with stress relief so that they don't move. Whereas a patch lead, you can't do that with. I'm more talking about using mechanical splice in the background. The only fusion splicing is kind of like a ripoff. In the early days of fiber optic, it was all, it's got to be a specialist thing. You've got to have magic tools and, you know, magic fingers and special mystic spells to be able to make it work. It's really not. A fusion splicer is still expensive. It's still hard to use and completely unnecessary for most data centers. Mechanical splicing works just fine, especially for data centers where money is more important or lowering cost is more important than reliability. Fusion splicing is a little bit more reliable because they wrap the cable back up and it's stronger and it's not susceptible to, you know, temperature changes or, you know, being moved or bumped or whatever. But it works fine. So if I was doing an education environment or, working for a charity where, you know, controlling costs, I would certainly be using mech splice instead of fusion splice every time.
So here's another 2012 wish that I have. I think I want to work on Cisco's web team and give them some inside information on how to make a website that isn't purely evil to navigate. And yeah, this came up the other day for me because I had a very simple thing. We have migrated up to Cisco ACS5. And I needed to figure out how to hand off a particular set of Radius IETF attributes in the response from the ACS server back to the requesting device so that it would know what it needed to know. I'll tell you what, man, ACS5 is not a lot like ACS4 in how it lays out. It has radically changed its policies. The way you build components and put a policy set together is quite a different animal now. Once you wrap your brain around it, it makes sense. But to try to find the documentation for ACS5, they've got this structure now where you go in to support, and almost everybody on the show has probably heard this, and then you drill in. It's somewhat hierarchical. And in principle, that sounds great. It's just that the things you think you should be able to find, you click through, and that's not what you wanted, and that's not what you wanted, and that's not what I wanted either. And then I finally say, screw it. I go to the search engine, and I have to search to get in there. Sometimes I try to back out once I finally find the document I want to figure out, well, where did they put this thing? Where did they tuck this document away?
It's going back to the days 10 years ago where you had to keep a link. Everybody collects bookmarks of what they did and used to swap bookmarks for things.
I still got that. I've got a big Cisco folder of things because I can never seem to find them the second time. Nope. Now, in all sympathy to Cisco, they have got a huge product portfolio. I mean, absolutely massive. There is no doubt about that. And they have done, obviously, a very deliberate job of trying to categorize things in areas that make sense. But, boy, I'll tell you, trying to find certain things is still failure. And I think, I got to wonder, did they sit with engineers and say, all right, we're thinking about doing this and going live with this on our website. But before we do, we want to see what you think. I wonder if they have those sorts of group studies and so on, because it seems like it shouldn't be this hard.
They do. And they've reached out to me in the past. You remember I had a big whine on about a few years earlier in the year? And Cisco, we were complaining about the new thing and how slow it went and all that sort of stuff. And they did reach out to me and they did show me what was coming up. I do think they are making headway. And as you say, they've got an awful lot of information. But I think it's the product managers who are to blame here. Cisco goes and buys only these people who don't take the time to learn how the website works and just stuff everywhere. So one product will have good white papers in the white paper section. And then they'll have the configuration documents in the operations section, and then they'll have the design guides. Well, they don't have any. Different products have different things. They don't
exactly put it, right. Yeah. And then some things have dead links as well, where they just haven't quite kept up on. Well, I actually found this ACS document that I was looking for. A very straightforward document. It was the user guide. Hmm. And found a link embedded in the document that said, this is how you did it in ACS4. This is how you do it now in ACS5. Like, oh, good. That'll be probably a helpful transitional tool for a guy like me that's used to old ACS. Click on it, dead, 404. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, you can go and search and find the document from there, and I was able to do that. But that's not an uncommon thing to find dead links embedded in Cisco documents of things that you want. So
I agree with you. That's a difficult one to do. I would like to see more done, but they aren't paying to ask our help. So when last time they got in contact, I was sat on a conference call with them for 4 hours talking about different things. And, at the end of it, I sort of went, my time's worth money. And if they want my help, I kind of want to get paid for it.
Yeah.
And as somebody who does use the product a lot, I just really don't have the time available to just, make its suggestions on how to fix Cisco's website. I sort of expect professionals to be able to fix their own things.
I agree with that completely.
Why should I have to fix, theoretically these guys are professionals. Shouldn't they know what they're doing? There's a certain point beyond which competency should exist. One thing that I'd personally do myself right now is whenever I hit a page and you can get a PDF version of that page, so white papers, design guides, always take a copy of that set PDF file and save it on your hard drive.
I do a lot of that as well. Yep, I've got a pretty big library of PDFs that I've found, and periodically, if I refer to it, I go, "Oh, I think they got a new version out. I better go check and see if it's an update to this document." Mm-hmm. But I've got a pretty extensive PDF library I've built offline for exactly that reason. Plus, they're handy and portable too, so you can carry them about with you.
Yeah, and I actually now have a special program to archive them and group them, and I also tag them so I can search for them later on. But that's a productivity thing. That's the way I choose to work. Something that's been working with me lately is I've been doing a lot of a big project around firewall logging. I've got to do a project for working out what firewall rules are in use and which ones aren't.
So if you're at liberty to say, set the stage for me this way, because I've done a lot of this last year myself.
Mm-hmm.
Roughly how many firewalls are you coping with and how many records per day are generated on aggregate?
Well, therein lies the challenge. At the moment, it's about 40 firewalls, and they're all in a data center, and they're all virtual. I don't know how much logging they're generating. I'd say it's a lot at this point in time, but I can't find the information. The organization is distributed globally and finding the people who own the logging.
Easily millions of records, it sounds like, though.
That's right. So they manage their Cisco firewalls with Cisco Security Manager.
Yeah.
They have Checkpoint. But the checkpoint's not the current focus of the project. The current focus of the project is on fixing up the Cisco FWSM configurations. So I have two options. I have using a tool called Splunk, which is a logging product, or I could get something, one of the SolarWinds products, probably their logging and event management product. I just wondered if you've got any views on which one you should use.
So I've done a few things. I did a bit of a Splunk evaluation. I've used the Checkpoint product for quite a while, and I've also used Cisco Security Manager. I have not tried the SolarWinds product yet, although SolarWinds is definitely my wheelhouse. I've used a lot of other SolarWinds products. Let me comment on SolarWinds for just a moment, which is to say I do use, built into the NPM product, they've got a syslog daemon there. Now, I wouldn't want to use that specific product to handle millions of records. You'd have to scale the box out appropriately to deal with that, and you really want SolarWinds NPM. That's their network performance manager product. You really want that to be focused on that and doing SNMP polling and those sorts of things, not doing syslogs for you. Now, that said, there is a pretty powerful alert manager daemon that sits back there so that when syslog events are received, the alert manager daemon will parse through logs as detailed as complex regex expressions if you want, and then do an escalation in whatever way you might imagine, email alerts and on and on. So I'm speculating, because of typically how SolarWinds stuff goes, that the Log Event Manager product is going to have all of that power and more to be able to deal with an extremely high volume of records. I mean, did you get a chance to look at LEM at all?
I did. I've been doing some research into it lately as part of a separate piece of work I've been doing, and it does have all of those things. So it has Splunk-like features. So Splunk, for those people who don't know, was an open source project that started for a guy working for SourceForge, and he needed to manage SourceForge's logging capability. So he built a program in C that munged the logs and then presented a web interface, and then wrote the web interface in such a way that you could just say, type regexes and stuff in a web browser, and then save those searches for future, search as a search pattern, and then you could look through the logs and keep repeating those searches time after time. The thing about Splunk is you send it syslogs, it munges them, indexes them, and then presents them on a web interface that you can then drill down through it. LEM has the same thing. It has a web interface into a log manager, and like Splunk, it has a whole bunch of smart, intelligent things that you can do. It has, 300 or 400 predetermined log rules that you would typically want to know, like munge your Windows Active Directory logs or munge your Windows servers or your Linux logs, and it'll present them to you as a report. And it also does serendipity type stuff. So it gives you this word cloud or top this or unusual that, and it will bring them to your attention so that you can go and look at that and go, hang on, that shouldn't be happening in my gee, I'm glad I found that. There's a bug that I should have known about but didn't. I call those serendipity.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when you walk around your network, you go, why is that interface running at 80%?
Yeah.
Oh.
Now, the time I spent with Splunk was pretty good in that I was extremely impressed with the product. It's hierarchical. You can spread out a whole tree structure of Splunk servers that are handling events and then kicking them up a level if you needed to go that big. Splunk was very powerful. Its parsing engine was, you could do anything you wanted with it, really. The challenge that I found with Splunk specifically was just the price. There is a free version, but it caps out at, I think, 500 megabytes worth of logging data in a day, which if you're pushing millions of transaction records into a Splunk engine, that's you'll blow through 500 meg, no problem. At least I believe that was the limit at the time.
Yeah, no,
it is. When we got around to actually pricing out a full solution that would have been appropriate for our environment, it was quite a bit of money.
Reassuringly expensive.
it wasn't quite that bad, but as it wasn't a major budget item that we'd had, we were like, ooh, I don't think we can afford this. And so we kind of ended up with Cisco Security Manager for that reason. Now, CSM does more than just logging and parsing, although that is what I have ended up doing. That's what I've spent the most time with in CSM. Now, CSM also does policy management, where you can build a central policy and then deploy it to a set of firewalls. There's some workflow functionality in there. But CSM, it needs some maturing in that specific aspect as far as I'm concerned. in that we're running a lot of Cisco ASAs in the environment that I support primarily, and I leverage prefix lists, which was a feature that came in a fairly late code release of the ASA firewall, and CSM could not parse it because this prefix list had the way it presented itself up to CSM. There was a specific funny bug. CSM couldn't parse it, which meant it stopped trying to parse the configuration of this firewall at all, meaning it's not an object that this thing can manage anymore. So, you know, after wrestling with that and going back and forth with TAC and saying, them telling me finally, yep, it's a known bug. The solution is, don't use prefix lists.
Cisco Security Manager is a product that consistently has shown so much promise to actually be useful and then consistently fails to deliver that.
Well, you know, there are some people on Twitter that swear by it. There's a few of the guys out there, as I whined a bit about CSM, that really said it's a good deal. And for what it's worth on the logging engine aspect of it, I'm reasonably happy with it. It's not a screaming performer. It does tend to bog down a bit if you're trying to parse through a whole lot of logs. But you can, generally speaking, find what you're looking for. With some caveats, I don't know how you would compare the log parsing engine in CSM versus Checkpoint's log parsing engine, the SmartView Tracker program.
The problem I have with both of those is they're both so slow. So when you go into Firewall One, you know, Event Manager, and you type something, it takes a long time for it to generate a response. And CSM is even worse than that. It's just using that CSM client uses a 300 meg Java file to run as a client. And the client runs like a pig. And CSM uses Java Tomcat. It's a Java server app. And even like it needs 24 gigs of memory to run more than 50 firewalls. That is just an astonishing footprint. And it still runs like a pig. It is so slow to run Cisco Security Manager. That's my biggest whine with it. It's just slow.
Yeah, I'm not dealing with as many firewalls as that, but...
But you know when you're in Cisco Security Manager, you just click on a firewall, and then you wait for the screen to repaint.
Yes.
It takes 5 to 10 seconds to repaint that screen.
Yes.
Right? And then you click on something, and then it takes 5 or 10 seconds to repaint the next. And it is so annoying. It really shouldn't do that, right?
With all the horsepower that's in a CPU today, even in a virtualized environment, the number of CPU cycles you can throw at a process, it seems like a process has got to be written woefully inefficiently if it's that much of a dog. It doesn't seem like in 2012 now that there should be an excuse for that kind of thing.
Well, there's no, to my mind, it's probably the problem with Java. It only runs on Windows. Why are they using Java? So the idea behind Java was that it was meant to run once, run anywhere. So I should be able to take the CSM and use it on my Mac or my Linux or, you know, whatever. I can't. It only runs on Windows, and it only runs with particular versions of Java runtime engine, and it runs like crap. It has run like crap for many years, and I like CSM in the point of view that it gives me policy control across many firewalls and a nice GUI console that is operationally coherent, but it is slow. It is so slow as to be, like, frustratingly annoying. And I cannot understand why they haven't developed a custom, like a proper native app for this.
It seems like that would be the answer to absolutely make it smoke. But my comparison with slowness would be parsing records in a log because I'm looking for something specific. I'm doing some sort of forensic analysis or I'm trying to troubleshoot a specific problem.
Yep.
And if I'm using CSM to parse through a day or two or three's worth of records versus Checkpoint's engine, the Checkpoint is blindingly fast compared to CSM, which is a real disappointment.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, I also did at one point in my life do all of this in a Linux box using sed and awk and, you know, all sorts of fun things. But that requires a level of that was fine when I had only a few things to do in my life. And one of them was like configure switches, configure and run logging and network monitoring servers. In the modern era, I can't. You know, if you've ever built sed and awk profiles, building those scripts is not intuitive to me anymore. And while I agree that it's the fastest and probably the best way to do logging, it's not practical for me to walk around with a head full of those types of scripting capabilities anymore when I spend 75% of my time designing network backbones or, you know, architecting firewalls or, you know, having meetings about budget discussions. You know, that sort of detailed, you know, attention deficit sort of, you know, twitching on the keyboard to keep spinning up a said orc and then piping it and rejecting and grepping it and, you know, all that sort.
Yeah.
I don't have the time to build up that sort of knowledge base and to maintain it over time. And it's unfortunate, but I need something that's faster and easier to use. And that's what Splunk and LEM and Firewall One and CSM are supposed to give us.
Yeah, it seems very fair that when you pay for a product to do these things for you, it would do it extremely well, because the guys that coded this thing, that's what they do for a living. They're coders. Yeah. They're software engineers. And so therefore, you'd expect to have an optimal performance experience right out of the box and not have to hack it together yourself to make it go the way you want.
That's right. I mean, you know, doing log files, using a syslog daemon, you know, syslogng in Linux, and then using sed and awk to go over the log files is very fast. But it also requires a level of focus and familiarity with how it all works that just takes a year, you know, months to build up that sort of knowledge to make it useful. And it's like a muscle that you have to exercise constantly to keep going with that.
You know, talking about all this log stuff kind of popped another question in my mind, which is, I had a little bit of a scare the other day. It was a false alarm, nothing to worry about. But the question that popped in my mind is this. Will you get alerts from your alerting station if your internet link is down? And what I'm getting at is this. A lot of times we get our alerts escalated to us through our email system. That's our preferred way to receive an alert. If you're like me, you've probably got a bunch of munging rules on your inbox. So that is different items come into your inbox. It gets shuttled off to different folders and different reactions that you might take. Okay, so what happens if your internet link is what's dead and you can no longer get email off of your main site where your monitoring system is? Are you prepared to deal with that sort of a situation? There's a lot of ways you can work around this. Greg, maybe I'll see, have you done any workarounds for this sort of a situation?
Oh, I've done loads. there's no right answer here. The answer is, of course, it depends.
Yes. Well, I mean, and it all depends on what's available to you. You know, is a big dependency. I mean, one thing that popped into my head was that's an obvious one is the plain old telephone system. POTS. Just get a POTS line into your monitoring system with a modem, so that it can pump out maybe an SMS message or hit a different internet circuit, perhaps. Cradlepoint, for example, makes an access point that can connect you to a 3G network. So if your internet is completely down at your site, it'll connect you off to the cell network. I mean, you'd need a USB 3G or 4G modem that could connect you up there and the proper account and so on. But that would be another way to get you to the internet when your main circuit is down. And then, of course, a completely different approach. Don't think about your main data center as the only place to do monitoring. Maybe you need to have a secondary monitoring system that's off-site somewhere else, whether that would be something you crowdsource, you put up some sort of monitoring up in the cloud, or maybe you've got another office that you could do some monitoring from, so that you would know, oh, headquarters just took a hit. And I can't get in and out of headquarters now. Your secondary office would tell you that, mm-hmm. that there's a problem when you're getting alerted that way.
Yeah, I've done some things. I've purchased external services to monitor email systems. So actually connects to the email system, sends a message, and then disconnects. And if it stops, then it actually sends an email to a Gmail account or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be bought quite cheaply, $10, $20 a month.
Yes, one of the companies I worked at, we had an external service that would do live web transactions where it would hit an internet-facing gateway for a specific service that we were offering, make sure that it could authenticate, submit a transaction, get the expected response back. And if that either broke altogether or fell below a specific threshold, it would let us know. And that was an interesting one in that it was distributed globally, this particular service. And so if the Los Angeles gateway was working well, it wouldn't take that for granted because the Singapore monitoring site might be going quite poorly. And you get a profile of exactly where in the
your
world.
Your monitoring system's in Los Angeles, but Los Angeles is down, but you've got MX Records in Singapore and London that are still
right. So that's a good thing to think about with these outsourced monitoring systems. If they're distributed worldwide, it can alert you to problems that if you're very headquarters-centric and sometimes forget to think outside the box how the rest of the world's seeing you, it'll bring these things to your attention.
Yeah, lots of the devil's in the detail for that one. You've got to keep thinking. You've got to keep recursively thinking about what's going on those things. Because, yeah, if you think, oh, I'll just poll a mail server, the question is how many mail servers do you have?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, indeed.
Awesome. Yeah, the other one I've done in the past is when I read this and you said if your internet goes down, the other one I thought of was how do you detect if your internet connection fails over? And that can be very difficult to do sometimes.
Well, I mean, this really opens up a larger discussion because it's not just, you know, internet failing over. There's we could really get into a discussion about just testing failover designs in general. Mm-hmm. This is one of those things where we design them, we understand the protocols and how they're supposed to work, we configure them, we put them in place, and then we never test them. And then something actually breaks. You're like, "Oops, that did not work."
Didn't think of that.
So well.
That's unexpected.
So I mean, it should be part of every network engineer's business planning, if you will, that there's a term in business called business continuity planning. Mm-hmm. Disaster recovery would factor in under this. And when you go to the business to say, I need a window of time wherein I can prove that when we fail over, things work right. Once the business understands what you're doing and why, it should be amenable to them to give you that time. I mean, and there's a lot of good justification for why you would want to test a failover design. I mean, even simple stuff breaks because people make mistakes. I've seen any number of HSRP configurations, for example, where someone forgot to put in the authentication string, and so you've got two HSRPs sitting out there, misconfigured.
Yep. Or worse, somebody didn't put a password on, and somebody's just configured a third one.
Yes.
That's why you put a password on, kids, so that if somebody brings up a third one, it reduces your risk.
But I mean, that's just a super simple example, right? HSRP. Many people on the show have configured hundreds or maybe even thousands of interfaces with HSRP and know how they work and know how to check them. And that's an easy thing to mess up. Well, what about a complex design? What about something really complicated? When you get into internet-facing gateways, for example, the designs that you have to put together to make that application that faces the internet be truly redundant and automatically fail over. There's a lot of moving pieces in that. There's a lot of stuff that goes on. And so there's a lot of opportunity for things to not work right or for things you didn't consider or you didn't think about to show up. I mean, you can whiteboard it to death. Sometimes the whiteboard doesn't show you everything that there is to show.
That's right. There's so many things like NAT cause a particular pain because NAT is stateful. And a failover occurs, you lose sessions because NAT has to statefully fail over. So then you're trying to statefully fail. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Or failing over VPNs between sites. That's always like, yes.
So, I mean, maybe in 2012, here's some stuff that would be worth testing. One would be failover routing or any sort of multipath. And this could be simple or could be complex depending on what your layout is. But if you've got multiple paths to get from point A to point B, and you're expecting to be able to use both of those paths, have you tested the secondary path, your backup path? Now, depending on how your layout is, maybe you're using both of them in real time because it's an active-active, and so that's less of a concern for you. So then I have another question, which is, if you lose one of the two or three or four links, do the remaining links have enough capacity to handle the load, which is something else that has come up? Oh, well, we don't need to have, we don't need to have as much bandwidth here on this backup link because it's just a backup link. You know, it's going to carry some of the traffic and it's fine. Okay, well, I'm explaining this poorly, but think about it this way. Let's say you've got two links that are active-active and they're both going at 75% capacity all the time. And you're thinking to yourself, I've got 25% overhead. That's great. Right until one of those links goes away, now you're trying to cram 150% capacity through a link, and you've got a major bottleneck. So that's another one of those things to test and to think through in your designs when you're doing failover stuff. You know, another thing here that's more of a simple thing, but hardware pairs. We hardware pair stuff to death as a means of building redundancy and resiliency into an environment. You can have redundant supervisor engines. You can have redundant core switches, a pair of Catalyst 6500s or Nexus 7000s or 5000s sitting in the core of your network.
And then running balancers. VSS and VPC. And
Yes.
So now you've got four supervisors in a 6500 chassis participating in VSS to make them look like one. You know?
Well, you take that level of complexity and load balancers are often built as a high availability pair, as are firewalls. And you can also do the same kind of a thing with top of rack, end of row switches, where you've built two of them and you've got, you know, half of your links from your host plugged into one switch, half of the other half plugged into the other one. Switch stacks are in there. All of these hardware pairs have a particular methodology behind them that make them work and make them redundant. You got to test that stuff by breaking half of it and make sure that everything fails over the way you expect it to fail over, because what's probably going to happen here is it's not going to fail over exactly like you think. And it's funny, you know, redundant supervisor engines tend to work okay. Load balancer pairs, like I have done a lot of work with F5, that tends to work just fine. Most of those are state aware enough that there's essentially no hit. And I've certainly heard stories over the years where someone's done a supervisor engine or experienced a supervisor engine failover in a CAT 6500 and didn't even know it happened.
And tracking those requires custom programming of SNMP MIPS. So coming back to our network management thing, you actually have to poll slot 5 and this MIB to detect if that supervisor's active. And then there's this another point in the MIB, which is slot 6. To detect if this one's active. And that's the only signaling that you get as an external management. So if this goes from 0 to 1, then that supervisor's gone active. And that's the only notification you might get.
Yes, exactly right. You need to you've got to be able to capture a different sort of event. Say you've got a Cisco ASA firewall pair fail over. You can maybe catch a syslog event that says, oh, I just had a failover event, and then escalate that up as an alert.
But that's reactive. It's hard to – I mean, in terms of that, capturing a log and then matching it assumes that one message, which happens once a year maybe, that you've actually have specifically programmed your – but you've got no way of proving that capturing that syslog is actually going to happen without generating that message and testing it.
Depending on the nature of the failure, you can't even prove that the syslog event that was generated ever actually made it into the
network. That's right. So syslog is a reactive management tool, and it's not good for detecting failovers in my view. You've got to be polling for it constantly. And the problem with polling the ASA MIB is when they fail over, the IP address goes with them. So if you're polling the HA address of the SNMP MIB and it fails over, you're actually still polling the active unit.
That's exactly right. You have no idea which unit physically you're actually talking to.
Yeah, you actually have to poll the SNMP MIB on the management interface, and you have to poll it for the hardware device, not the software device. There's a special MIB inside the ASA, so it's not easy to do.
Another thing that comes up with when you actually create a failover event, you know, another thing that happens here is there's timers involved that, depending on the protocol that you're working with, that can cause confusing behavior for a temporary amount of time while the timer is waiting to expire before things kick over. Sometimes we expect, if I reboot this thing, if I pull this cable out, if I, whatever it is you do to try to simulate a failure, things are going to immediately reconverge on the other link or on the other piece of hardware or in the other direction, whatever the case may be. And it doesn't always work that way. And so one of the things that doing failover testing is going to reveal is whether or not those timers need to be tuned and whether or not what the state of the network is during the transition time between your preferred known good state and the failed over state. And that's not... That's not to be taken for granted. That's something that actually matters. I was thinking about HSRP, for example. You can do sub-second HSRP failover if you want to. Now, there becomes questions. Don't I just want to, you know, ratchet the timers down to be as fast as possible? Well, do you? The reason being, if you have a transitional event in your network, maybe a flapping link that is introducing a certain topology and then removing the topology and then reintroducing it again, and this is all happening very quickly, these things do happen. Do you want your timers reacting that quickly to each event, or do you want there to be some sort of let's wait and see how this works out before the timers actually kick in behavior? Again, failover testing brings out all of these things. I guess a larger point here is that you don't want the time to figure out your failover solution isn't working exactly as you expected is during a failure. You don't want that to be revealed to you. Wow, why isn't my failover working? How come I can't get to the disaster recovery site yet? How come? You don't want to be asking a lot of how come questions where you got managers freaking out and standing over your shoulder. You want to have tested this ahead of time to show up your errors and your mistakes, to see if there's any timers that need to be tweaked, to find out that, ooh, that redundant supervisor engine actually doesn't do anything because it's been broken and we didn't know.
That's right. And it's better to test in a controlled environment when
during
you're
a scheduled maintenance window
than it is to find out that the supervisors failed at 2 o'clock in the morning on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Or, you know, some other time which is mutually inconvenient. So, which does happen a lot. I agree. You can't, and convincing your manager to give you a time slot to do testing is very difficult. In the modern era where people are always afraid that if you change something, it will break and then you'll have an outage and SLAs will be broken and you'll need to engage your political skills to make that happen. It's complicated.
It depends on the business as well. A lot of businesses are right on top of it and get it and they see it. Other ones will give lip service and say, yes, we understand that you need this maintenance window. However, we can't afford to give that to you right now. Yeah. And they won't give it to you until all of a sudden something's broken. They say, you know, if we had a chance to test that, this wouldn't have happened.
Yes. What you need to do is make sure that you write that down ahead of time in an email and say, I told you so.
In a very professional
yes.
way.
Yes, of course. Yes. You don't stand in front of them and blow raspberries and going, I told you. You indicate that you'd considered this valuable technology investment and raised concerns about the ongoing productization and, you know, service delivery and to develop an appropriate schedule for testing, but that was rejected.
Oh, you want to change gears for a minute?
Yeah, for sure.
Here's another thing that cropped up reading blogs and writing some of my own stuff here. This question kind of popped in my head, which is there seems to be a growth in blogging, right? This has been ongoing for years now, but even within networking, there has been an addition of new bloggers out there, which has been great. I keep stumbling on new blogs and links as I read comments and so on. So, and it's good stuff, man. I like reading independent bloggers. So the question is, why do independent bloggers seem to write more compelling content than career journalists when it comes to networking? And there's a lot of guys out there that write about networking, or at least write about technology, you know, for a living. And I've seen both sides of the world now a little bit. I'm starting to understand how both of these worlds work. Greg, I think you've done, you know, quite a bit more in that world than me. You got some insight into this?
It's complicated. The career journalists, and I guess we could also extend this to talk about analyst firms as well. If you're a career journalist working for, say, a major, you know, one of the bigger blog sites and one of the big media concerns, because many of those well-known names are actually owned by the big media people, and they are. So the first thing is that those companies have special access to the vendors. So the vendors have PR teams, and inside the PR teams they have press people whose whole job it is to give access to the press or information to the press. And the journalist's job is to try and get access to information that the PR doesn't want to give them, and the PR is to try and give them the information that they want them to write about. And there's a whole dance that goes on there, which is a bit, you know, a bit creepy. Because it's actually a more of a deathly embrace. That is, the journalists and the analysts need the vendors to give them the information, and the PR people actually want to give information to them but don't want them to give the stuff that they don't want. So they actually need each other. They actually have to – so that it's more friendly. If somebody gets critical – writes a critical article, then the PR people will be less inclined to give them access in the future, or invitations, or something like that. Or if the PR people give away too much information, they'll get criticized internally. Or if the PR people give away too much stuff that's just marketing rubbish, the journalists just won't cover them at all. So is a journalist truly independent with a vendor when they depend on the vendor to provide them the information that they need to write about? And where do the journalists get their sources from? Whereas independent bloggers like us write about our own personal experiences from our own point of views, and our biases tend to be clearly on display. A journalist tends to say, you know, I'm not biased, but as a matter of fact, it's hard for them to criticize companies like Cisco because Cisco might stop inviting them to attend press briefings and things like that, like Apple does.
That's one of the things that I really find the most compelling as I read guys like me, just other engineers that are out there using products, is you get the sorts of insights that only come when you have a hands-on personal experience with a specific product or technology. Mm-hmm. A journalist is not really going to give you that. They're going to give you, as you were pointing out, the
big picture.
It's the sound bites, the press release, so it's got it's made of unobtainium plated blah blah, and it's so much faster than this, and it uses buzzwords like world class and global delivery platforms, and most of which I don't care about, because I know that this new product that was released is just a new iteration of X, and X wasn't all that great before, and I'm not really convinced reading about unobtainium global delivery platforms that it. I don't care. What I want to know is the guy that actually did the upgrade to this new software release or installed the new appliance and is using it and says, this is pretty great, or this is pretty great with caveats, or I like this, but I don't like this. And you can't seem to really get that sort of depth. Even with the product reviews, they oftentimes don't get that, because it's so – product reviews tend to be very numbers-based. Oh, we did a bake-off between this switch, and, this one was faster versus this one.
So now you're getting into the analyst firms. So this is the big analyst firms like Gartner and Forrester and so forth. And here it is even more gray, right? When you read those analyst reports, they all look very interesting sometimes, but they're actually not very valuable. The thing about analyst firms like Gartner and those types of, and Gartner particularly, is that Gartner is both a customer of Cisco, in that Cisco pays them to write reports, and Cisco is also a source of information. So if Gartner was to be too, so if you're an analyst firm, right, whoever you are, and you're dealing with a vendor, if you criticize them too much, the vendor won't spend money with you to write more reports, or they might not buy your reports that you've written about the state of the industry because you're too biased one way or the other. So an analyst firm has a very difficult dance to do. They can't criticize a vendor because the vendor is actually a customer as well as a source of information, as well as the target of their papers. So they've either got to write them so that they'll buy them, or write them because they were paid to write them. And so that's why when you look at the analyst reports, you always need to look at where it came from. And you'll find a lot of Gartner reports or, performance reports that are done by a vendor actually have a thing at the top saying who paid for it. Make sure you read that, because then it'll tell you. Because what happens is the vendors write a test plan. So, these performance reports that we see that says, this switch did this and this and this. What happens is the vendor writes a test plan and then pays the analyst firm to run the test plan. And the test plan that they're asking them to run is exactly the one that puts their product in the best possible light. It ignores all of their worst things. And what the vendor actually does is it has a thing called a competitive team, and their job, and Cisco's got dozens of these all around the world, and they have labs full of kit, and these people sit there, run the tests, make sure that they'll work properly, write the test up, and then hand it out to an independent party to run that same test and prove that it's actually...
Isn't to say that every analyst report out there is junk. I mean, you can find some information in there, but you've got to understand the bias that it came from. And if there's money involved, there's a bias involved. Yeah,
but there's no bias in that test, right? They're running the test plan that the vendor asked them to run and paid them to employ people to run that test. right? So there's no bias on part of the analyst firm there.
Well, in a sense, in that scenario that you're talking about, the test itself, is, you could say, is biased or is rigged in the vendor's favor. You know what I mean?
It's certainly one-eyed. It is not an independent test of the equipment. The days of independent testing are done. Because in the old days, Scott Bradner used to run a testing lab at one of the universities in the US, and all the vendors would submit, and he would run his tests, and then the vendors all pulled out because they weren't getting the results they wanted. So and it's expensive to run these independent testing facilities. Like, to be able to run, say, a 10 gigabit switch test, you have to have an Ixia or a Spirent or a, you know, these type of a breaking point testing rig, and those things cost like $500,000 to $750,000. For just a handful of 10 gig ports. And then you have to have the power, and then you have to have every piece of kit that you need. And that you can't do that without vendor support. And that's why we don't get independent testing results anymore, is because the vendors can't control the message. You know, the short-term thinking. There's only this quarter's sales. You know, it's important to just, you know, get it out there. We can't take any criticism because that's bad for marketing, that type of stuff. One of the other problems that I have with analysts from time to time is that they're often not technically strong. So your average analyst spends a lot of time searching for new sales opportunities, and their job is to be friendly with vendors or customers who buy the reports or whatever. And so their technical capabilities are not always as good as you might want them to be, and that can be a problem. Sometimes you read these reports that come through, and they're comprehensive, they're well written, they're often well structured, and the testing plans are often reasonably rigorous, but they're not always testing the best features or the features that you actually want, because the analyst firms often aren't employing good people or the strongest people. And that's because the customers have got the strongest people or the vendors. Who would want to work for an analyst? You know, yeah. It's hard to imagine, you know, that sort of job at an analyst firm is a really odd one. And I'm not sure that it's well built for engineers who want to be strong in engineering. Like, for people who are doing real world experiences, working for an analyst firm doesn't seem an attractive job to me. So I wouldn't expect their reports to be technically strong, because that's not their business. Their business is to write reports, not to be technically competent. And that's why bloggers are better.
Exactly. When you're an independent blogger, then you have the opportunity to write about a product or a technology from your perspective, a real world use case scenario, where you say, this is what I bought the product to do, this is how I employed it, and this is how it's working for me. This is what I like, this is what I don't like, this is how you accomplish X with it, and so on. This was the expense to our company. This is the ongoing expense as we deal with maintenance. This is what support was like when I called up. This is how the upgrade process went. All those things that are the specific day-to-day nuts and bolts of how you use networking kit out there in the field, out there in the companies and the data centers that we all support, those things very often tend to not come up in analyst reports as well, or not with the focus or not with the detail that you'd like to have, where you're left with, you know, performance results as opposed to what's my life going to be like day-to-day using this product. Independent blogging really gives you the opportunity to get that voice out, to talk about things from that perspective. And that, for me personally, is what I find much more valuable. When I do a Google search looking for something not from the vendor side about a particular product, I'm always happy to find that one of the blogs that I follow has covered them. And, you know, speaking of that, Greg, I made a list of just a few blogs that are out there that I have. And some of these are pure techie, and some of them are actually a little bit different, but I just – that maybe some other folks would be interested in here as we go into 2012.
Sure.
One of those is Marco Linio writes majornetwork.net. So a majornetwork.net, it's one of those blogs where Marco doesn't write a super lot. It's not like he's grinding out articles all the time, but what he does have is really good. Kind of like Chris Margot at fragmentationneeded.net. He's not blogging every day, but when he does blog, there's a lot of really good content that's there. Mark, who tends to write about data center stuff, Cisco Nexus, you know, in these sort of details. He's written things that I've found helpful, where he's pointed out new iOS features that have cropped up in the Catalyst 6500 line, things that he's run into with the Nexus and so on, worth subscribing to. RevolutionWiFi.blogspot.com, Andrew Von Nagy, who I was able to meet in the past, either I think it was Interop New York City. I was able to meet him, write some great stuff, and I found his blog. Well, I mean, I knew about him anyway, was subscribed, but I have also found his blog just doing Google searches, looking for certain technologies that I needed to know more about. For example, I was looking for kind of a quick description of how to take a Cisco wireless access point that tunnels by default back into a wireless LAN controller, and then have it work as a standalone access point for a remote office application where some traffic would be tunneled and some not. And he had a great write-up on exactly how that works, what the caveats are, and so on, written by an engineer for an engineer, so that he already knows the concerns that you got, and it's good stuff.
Yeah, I met him at Wireless Field Day last January. Wireless Field Day is coming up in a couple of weeks. I'm actually looking forward to tuning into some of that stuff. I won't be going this year, but we will be supporting, and they have a wireless symposium as well. So do you know how we did the OpenFlow symposium in October?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're running another version of that called the Wireless Symposium, which will also be worth talking into.
I've already got that on my calendar. I think the second or third week of January. I've forgotten now already, but it's already marked in, so you can tune into techfieldday.com and watch the streaming video. That'll be coming out of that event, no doubt, from Stephen Foskett and crew.
So. Yes. The symposium that the idea that we had when we brought that together is going to be interesting to see how that goes, because I'm looking forward to seeing that grow, doing more of those perhaps in the future.
So let me throw another techie kind of a blog at you out there that's really focused on virtualization, virtualinsanity.com. I mean, there's several different guys that write at virtualinsanity.com, and again, this is another one. I stumbled into this one recently through a Google search and found a whole bunch of very technical articles dealing with VMware, networking on VMware. Some of it I wasn't as interested in as others just because of what my particular focus is in the technology world, but just very strong content, well documented with diagrams and a well-written group of writers. So happy to have that in there. In my newsreader, which, by the way, I've been using Feedly because Google Reader has upset me greatly, and so I've tried Feedly.
Is Feedly an online thing? Is that an online?
Yeah, Feedly's online, and the way Feedly works is it actually goes to your Google Reader, it imports all of your subscriptions that are there, and it keeps everything synced with Google Reader, but it presents the news to you, it presents the articles in a very different way.
Yeah.
And there is also an excellent iOS application for that, iOS as in iPhone, iPad, etc. And I really like it. I can't say I'm 100% in love yet just because of the way it handles marking articles as read or not and where it's pulling the information from. I haven't quite made sense of exactly how it's delivering what's on a specific Feedly page to me yet, but I'm getting there. I'm getting the vibe, and it's definitely worth a shot.
I use a desktop-based thing. I don't believe in this web cloud thing much.
It's a fad.
It is a fad.
What are you using?
I use a Mac application called Reader, R-E-E-D-E-R. I used to use NetNewsWire, but switched to Reader. It costs $6 on the Mac App Store. I think it might be $7 now. And it's just great. And I link that to a thing called Instapaper, if you've not heard of it.
So I have heard of it, yeah.
So if I read something that I'm interested in, but I don't want to read it now or before, you know how on the RSS feed it falls off the end after a while?
Yes.
So I link it to Instapaper, which holds it permanently for me. And then I have applications on my iPad, and I have another program on my Mac called Read Now, which downloads it so I can read offline. So if I'm on the train or traveling somewhere or I'm working on a customer where I've got no Wi-Fi or no access, I can still sit in my Instapaper offline and read websites. I don't have to be somewhere. And it's much – or sitting on the sofa or, whatever, much more pleasant than reading stuff on the web because it strips out all the ads and stuff as well, just gets the content down.
Ooh, strips out all the ads. That can't be a bad thing.
Well, it doesn't strip them out. It's sort of – it drops it into a readability format, which is nice. I mean, in one sense, the ad thing is – we do have ads on our website, and it's how we fund – of the websites that we run.
So, yes, we do. Please click.
Please click. and it does run. And the cost of managing the website is going up, unfortunately, because of the scale of the business that we run now for that. So we got a contact from the web hosting provider to say that we're now running 250,000 unique IPs a month, which I think is a problem. My recollection is that we're getting about 100,000, but we're working with them on that. And but you know, it does cost a lot of money to run the website actually because of the size of it now.
Right.
Getting a bit of pain. But yeah, Reader is very good, and it plugs into my Gmail, the Google Reader thing. So if I ever needed to just see the original Google Reader, I could go there, or I have other applications. So I have a different one called NewsRack on my iPhone. And because I'm old and my eyes are fading, I need something that's very high contrast
yeah.
on the iPhone because it's so small. But, you know, there's all different ways to read it. But RSS feeds, everybody should have an RSS feed and should start with Google Reader. And then when you feel that it's not right for you, start to look at other ways of using, of reading your content that's more pleasant for you personally to read.
Let me throw a few other things that you can pop into your Google Reader or whatever your RSS feed consumption device of choice is. These are less pure technical and more... you know, more about the industry that I have found pretty interesting. Now, here's a couple that are about what's going on in the background behind these companies that are very often in Silicon Valley. One is called Inorganic Growth, and it's about tech merger and acquisition. So this is the URL, which we're going to link to in the show notes, blogs.the451group.com/tech-deals. And what they do is they have kind of give you some insight into why one company might buy another, why the technology of this company would be interesting to this other company, and what they speculate might be done with that technology. That's interesting to me. I kind of like to know when Cisco buys someone why they did it, or when Hewlett-Packard acquires someone why they did it, and where that yep. goes.
So you can judge how long before they throw the product in the bin.
Right.
Like, exactly. Like Cisco Security Division has done a brilliant job of wasting every technology they bought in the last 10 years.
They haven't done overly well, unfortunately, no. Now, someone else with a lot of insight into that exact world is Brad Casemore. Now, Brad has a blog called nerdtwilight.wordpress.com. Twilight in the Valley of the Nerds is the formal title there of Brad's blog. And Brad's great. He knows a lot of guys in the industry. You know, I was able to meet Brad at New York City Interop this year as well, and he has a special insight into why some of these companies might want to be talking with one another, why people have made certain moves that they have, why certain product releases have come out, why certain company acquisitions might be going on, you know, what and a particular emerging product could be bringing to the table that's unique, and why it's a fit, and why a company positioned itself in a certain way. You know, Brad's writing style is very easy to read. He's got, again, a lot of insight onto what's really going on back there. And you kind of feel like you're getting a peek behind the curtain when you're reading an article by Brad. So it's good stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
Now,
I didn't know about the 451 group one. I'm going to add that to my Reader now.
Yeah, that one is it was a recent find I did, and it's, again, not frequently populated, but what's there is useful. Now, on the cusp of software-defined networking, OpenFlow and virtual networking, there are a couple of guys that work for Nicira that both have blogs. One is Martin Casado. Martin's blog is networkheresy.wordpress.com. And he tends to write, he tackles big issues surrounding software-defined networking. Now, I mean, he's big into this. He was part of the guy that helped get the OpenFlow spec out there. You know, he is very important in Nicira. And so he's certainly going to have potentially a Nicira-focused viewpoint, right? But but because they... you know, are leaders in software-defined networking and are doing some pretty interesting things, it's a pretty interesting blog to read. And along with that is another Nicira guy, Alan S. Cohen, Ineluctable Modality, alanscohen.wordpress.com. Same kind of thing. Now, neither of these guys are cranking out blog posts every day. They're not. But when they do, you want to read it because you're going to learn something that you didn't know before.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah, those guys are more, the last couple that you put out there are very open flow focused. So Nasira is an open flow. Alan S. Cohen just joined Nasira. Just keep an eye out for their slant as well. Brad is doing a great job. He's writing up some really good stuff.
Well, Mr. Farrell, what do you say? We've been yammering on for a while here, so what do you say we kind of bring this show to a close on one little tidbit of news, which is the rumored Apple iPad 3. Now, I have not owned an iPad. I have many friends who have, including you yourself. The iPad 3 has been, for me, the one that I've been waiting for. I think that I would use it every day. I would use it to do a lot of consumption of media, and the iPad 3 has got many more pretty pixels out there. I think 2048 by 1536 is the pixel count that I saw, which is a whole lot more than the 1024 by 768 that I believe is on the current iPad. Now, that appeals to me. My intent would be to use the iPad 3 for reading email and for reading PDFs and for consuming RSS feeds and the occasional shopping and whatever else, that kind of thing. Now, they're talking about releasing it or announcing it at the very least on February 24th, Steve Jobs' birthday. Supposedly, the screen supply issues that they've been having that prevented it from making the holiday season this year have been sorted out. Mm-hmm. There's been some other rumors that, well, look, they're putting refurbished iPad 2 out there on the Apple Store for kind of short money. You can get one for, you know, $420. That's usually $500. That's a pretty steep discount even for a refurb. I mean, that's all rumors, and I don't know anything concrete, but it certainly seems like the iPad 3 is upon us. So here's my question, Greg, since you are an iPad user, is the iPad 3 the one I want?
Probably. I think the iPad's been a great device in that, for me, it allowed me to free myself from the tyranny of a 17-inch MacBook because I have a big laptop because I do a lot of field work and move around. But it's just so big that it's uncomfortable. It weighs a lot. It's hard to move around. It's fragile. You know, it's been great, and it has worked brilliantly for me, but I need the iPad has freed me from that. So if I'm popping out on a Saturday morning to watch the kids do sport, I'll go and sit in a coffee shop and read, you know, PDFs or catch up on RSS feeds or things like that, which has been great. But the thing I'm discovering is that I'm just not a cut down sort of a guy. I need a keyboard. I'm doing a lot of writing at the moment. If it's not for Ethereal Mind or, you know, editing podcasts or, you know, writing blog posts to go with the podcast, I'm also doing commercial writing for companies and for some of the journalist sites, some of the big media sites. And the iPad just, it can do that. It can do a bit of writing, but it's not, you can't write 750-word blog posts on the iPad that without sort of wanting to bang your head on the wall consistently. Yeah, right. So I am eyeing off the next generation of MacBook Airs. So my future probably holds a new MacBook Air, and I will cease being an iPad owner as a result because it's the same size as an iPad. Like I was in the Apple Store the other day, and I was holding my iPad up next. Well, I got one of the iPad and held it up to an and, you know, they are almost the same size. And I'm sitting there going, I would much rather have a keyboard and something that weighs more or less the same as an iPad and have the same software. So I still have my word processors and my markdown editors and my – whereas every app I use on my iPad is like – it's not it, – it's getting around the limitations of the fact that there's no keyboard or there's no proper computer in there. And that's become a pain to me over time. So my future holds no iPads. I'll retire my. I've still got an iPad 1 that I bought, you know, the day that, you know, very close to when they released, and mm-hmm. it's been a great thing. And I still will probably continue to use it to read PDFs, but that is probably about it. But I think I'll replace it with a MacBook Air this year, and hope that by the later this year they will have new MacBook Pros. So these MacBook Pros that we have today are they're marvelous, but they're still big, and there's rumors going around that they'll take the current 17-inch and make it really, really thin, like the MacBook Air. Probably not as thin as the MacBook Air, but in that sort of, you know, that wedge idea that's much smaller because they don't have hard drives anymore. They'll all have SSDs. So I did a project before Christmas where I dropped an SSD into my MacBook Pro, which is going to get me through the last year, and then in October I'm going to have a look around at which one of the Macs I'll use to replace my MacBook Pro.
Now, MacBook Air, the one that you were comparing the size of to the iPad and going, these are coming in about the same the same weight and so on. I mean, the downside is, of course, it costs more money for a MacBook Air.
Yeah, it does, but it's a computer. So that's it's far more – the thing about an iPad is it's not a computer. So you can't use – what's happening to me now is I'm buying one set of software for my laptop, and then I'm buying another set of software for my iPad to do the same thing. And I'm buying it all twice. And that's, and it has to be said that Mac software isn't all that expensive, generally. So, you know, and software for the iPad is usually a dollar here or $5 there or $2 here, but it adds up. You know, I've sort of spent $300 or $400 US dollars on software for my iPad over time. And I'm looking at that saying, but you know, I could buy, I've already got those apps on my desktop. I wouldn't have to keep spending that money if I didn't need it. And it's, they are so tiny. They are just so enormously small. So if you, if you're not a Mac user, an iPad makes good sense, perhaps, because you've got nothing, you know, everything you need is going to be, it's a self-contained system. But for me, because I'm using, I'm a big user of Mac OS X, you know, I could have a MacBook Air and I could still have a Windows machine on there. So if I needed to run some sort of Windows app, I could. If I want to take my computer to work, I don't have to take a, you know, a big backpack. I can take a bicycle bag, you know, the side pouch type things with a MacBook in there. Uh-huh. And because they run for 10 hours, I don't have to drag the charger around with me. I could just take the MacBook and I could get by without charging it during the day. And when I get home, just plug it in the charger. Big differences. So lots of little things. It's a lifestyle choice for me. It'll be a MacBook Air next for me. No iPads in the future.
We'll see. I may. We'll see what the iPad 3 pricing comes in at, what the availability is going to be, what the options really are, and see beyond the more pixels on the screen, what's more wonderful about the iPad 3 that would make me want it, and then I'll go from there. I think I may try it. I may go for it this time. This will be it.
We should get you a MacBook. Turn you into a Mac user. I keep threatening to,
I have a friend who bought a MacBook Pro. He took a new job and needed to get a laptop. He bought a MacBook Pro, and he just dual boots Windows 7 for when he's going to do Windows work and Mac OS the rest of the time. And and he loves it. And I picked the thing up, and boy, the rigidity of that thing is amazing because it's made from billet aluminum and so on. And the backlit keyboard is beautiful, and the screen is very nice. And
yeah,
I gotta say, it does kind of inspire some.
Yeah, I use virtualization software. Sure. So I have a program called Parallels, and VMware does the same thing. There's a VMware something or another workstation for Mac. You actually have this mode where you can turn it into, I think it's called Crystal Mode. I can't remember what it's called, but you just turn it on, and then what happens is you go Command Tab between the different applications that you're running, and then the next one is Microsoft Word in Windows, Excel in Windows, Visio in Windows. So it just pops up as a Windows window inside of your Mac. You don't have to see it as a VM, if you know what I mean.
I gotcha. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Or if you're running dual monitors, you can actually put the Windows one on the whole second monitor. So I can take the emulator and say, right, my second monitor over there is the Windows machine.
Yeah.
On the left is the Mac, and on the right is the VM running Parallels, running Windows 7, and in there is my CSM and my, you know, checkpoint firewall tools and ADSM, ASDM and IDSM Java consoles and all that sort of stuff.
At the end of the day, if you're running a Mac, there's multiple ways that you can get back to the Windows world. It's not, you don't have to make much of a compromise. You can do it any way you want. You can run it natively, or you can run it, you know, virtualized as you're describing. So
that's true. All right, I think we should wrap it there. We've been chatting on for long enough, mate.
I'm afraid so. Easy to do, isn't it?
Yeah. For the two of us, so it would seem. So that's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to The Packet Pushers. We should be back again real soon. Make sure you come back. Thanks, Ethan, for joining us this week. Anything exciting? Spending money?
Well, right, ramping up for projects on 2012 for my company, which are going to involve some... Well, my pet project is IPv6. It's not like we have this huge driving business need. We've got to have IPv6 this year, but I want to make it happen. I want us to be IPv6 ready so that when the question comes down, we're going to just go, yes, we've got that. All the network's already done for IPv6. How may we serve you?
Yes. Further?
kind of thing. So that, and there's a voice project coming, and we've got Nexus 7000 coming, and it's all very exciting. And I'll be tweeting about it on Twitter at EC Banks. And of course, you can find me lots of other places, LinkedIn and Google Plus, Facebook, and so on. And if you start with Twitter, you can probably find me in the other places if you're interested in those as well.
And of course, I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me at etherealmind.com or on the Twitter as at etherealmind, and also around the other places, LinkedIn and Google Plus. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Alternatively, check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net and leave comments on the show notes. You can follow the show on Twitter as at packetpushers and on Google Plus as well. Sometimes there's a page there. As always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.